Bonnie knows when you plant something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie, gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. I'm the beverage director at a couple of restaurants downtown, Dell'Anima, Lartuzzi, Anfora, and La Picho. And this morning, I'm really excited to be here with someone I admire very, very much, someone who has been in the wine industry for some time, but brings a ton of enthusiasm, excitement, and a super high level of just quality and just a great guy all around. We have Patrick Capiello here on the show with us. He's the beverage director and partner of the highly reviewed Pearl and Ash. I actually brought my mom there for her birthday after going just a few days before with some wine industry friends. It's just a killer place. I'm just excited to have you on the show, Patrick.
I'm very excited to be here, Joe. Thanks.
Man,
I was wondering who you're talking about for a minute there. I was getting nervous there was going to be somebody important in the room with us.
Well, you know, I've known you for a little bit, and you have quite a, you know, you couldn't tell by looking at you, but you have 25 years in the industry. Tell us a little bit about how you got started.
You know, I started the way a lot of people, I think, that are in the industry did, and that's in front of a dishwasher and bussing tables when I was like 15. A restaurant called Crescent Beach Hotel in Rochester, New York. Yeah, which is and sadly no longer open. It's actually one of the many restaurants that I used to work at that are no longer open. Apparently, I have that gift, I guess. Hopefully not anymore, but... Yeah, so I bus tables and you know, it was, I did it as a spare job to be able to afford skateboard parts. Like, that was it. I was just a little skate punk who you know, spent almost as much time on a half pipe as I did in a restaurant, and then I went to school sometimes, and you know, after that was over, my next job after that was at Chili's. I was a bartender at Chili's, and then eventually a manager for a bit. That was all through college. Yeah, do you want me to keep listing it off?
Yeah, well, keep going. I mean, I think that's interesting. You find that a lot of times, great chefs are maybe the ones who weren't going to school so often. But I find that in the front of house, the sommeliers tend to be like more of the overachievers. You get the Thomas Pastuzics who like have three PhDs.
Right,
maybe that's a little overstating, but right.
Well, Thomas and I mean, actually, I did get my shit together at some point, and I went to college. I have a bachelor's degree in philosophy, which did me absolutely no good. Thomas, I believe, has a philosophy degree too. There's, I would say 50% of the sommeliers in New York City have philosophy degrees. So we have something interesting to talk about when we're all drunk, which is, you know, kind of fun. Maybe.
What was the first experience working in a restaurant when you're like, I want to do this? My calling.
I was living in Cleveland, Ohio. And I worked at a restaurant called the Baricelli Inn, which is also no longer open.
Oh, dear.
But it was like one of the fine dining destinations in Cleveland. And it was the chef owner had a decent wine collection. And, you know, there wasn't really anybody that knew much about it. I worked there with a guy named Nathan Wesley, who is now a senior editor at Wine Spectator. This is like 15 years ago, and one of my good friends. And Nate was actually the first person that kind of turned me on to wine. He gave me Kevin Zraley's Windows on the World because he knew I was interested, but I didn't have a lot of knowledge on wine. I mean, I grew up around it because I grew up in like the Finger Lakes region, Rochester, not too far from the Finger Lakes region. So there was wine around me, but that was normally like me and all my buddies like renting a party bus and just going from winery to winery, getting drunk. You know, it wasn't. I mean, then when you go to a winery in the Finger Lakes, they usually give you like the taste in like plastic solo cups. You know, what I mean?
I believe that's called the Long Island Challenge.
Yeah, exactly. but in the Finger Lakes, it's the upstate version. I was at Bertillon and Nate had a good knowledge and he used to hang around like wine bars in Cleveland, and he was really good at guiding me and got me into it. And then slowly I became kind of the go-to guy between him and I, the two go-to guys to talk to tables about wine, because there was no sommelier there, but there was like a 200 bottle wine list. It was cool. I still have a copy of the wine list someplace. I look at it every now and again. It's actually inside my windows on the World Book. And, so that spawned it. And then I decided to move to New York. I was going to come here. A friend of mine was going to make documentary films and I was going to help him. And I was looking for a restaurant job. And the owner of the Bertillon was like, yo, you should check out Tribeca Grill. It's a great standard in New York for restaurants. And they have a blossoming wine program. And, you know, David Gordon, who's a wine director there, I'm sure would be interested in, you know, working with you. And that's when I started there as a waiter. I worked under David and worked alongside with Yoshi Takamura, who I think you met at the Poly this year. And both of them became like my two real first mentors and inspirations. And I learned, you know, so much. I became the first sommelier that they ever had on the floor there, which was cool.
Can you tell us what year that was?
That was 2001. July of 2001, I moved to New York. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's remarkable. I think of Tribeca Grill as being around for a long time and having a great list for a long time, but they didn't really have a sommelier on the floor till 01.
Right. I mean, David was always on the floor. David would work in the front door or down in the office doing paperwork, and then if somebody wanted to ask about wine, he'd come upstairs and speak to him. But I mean, it was a very specific list. It was very focused on California and Chateau de Pop at that point. So, and the staff had a decent knowledge, but it wasn't a wine destination. You know what I mean? People would go there and most times you'd be like, oh man, this is a really big wine list. Like that was what you'd hear people like to shocked to know. Now I think we kind of assume it as being, because it's, you know, it's a Grand Award winner. And that was that first year we won the Grand Award, I think, was when things started to really, you know, take off. And then Yoshi was on the floor as a manager too, but he had to do double duty. I think now it's more common for sommeliers to do both, but he was a unique situation because he was like, David and him were both part of the management team. I was just a waiter. So they finally were able to convince the staff to let me in the tip pool as a sommelier. And that's all I did was, you know, was work the floor as a sommelier. So yeah.
Just to sell wine. Yeah. I mean, you see kind of two kinds of sommeliers. There's one who kind of what I did at Babbo was really just focus on selling wine. And then when you had free time and you weren't selling wine, then you could help run some dishes, whatever.
Right.
But, or the sommelier manager, when you're really much more involved in service.
Right. It means you got to close and do the paperwork.
Yeah, you got to do all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So then after 4 years there, which were unbelievable, Tim Kopeck hired me at Veritas, which was, you know, like, it was the most magical time to work at Veritas, too. It was sick. Like, you know, we were opening all the amazing bottles of wine. 2005, that was. So it's, you know, the economy still hadn't busted, but
before the crash, before everyone's,
yeah, when know. It was still cool to open a $10,000 bottle of wine, which people used to do all the time. It's crazy. When I first started there, I would write down the wines that I was opening. And then Tim Kopeck one day looked at me when we were like five bottles deep, like totally screwed. He's like, put that book away. I'm like, all right, yes, sir. And I never picked it back up. So I don't have any, you know, record. And God knows my brain is so broken at this point in my life that I couldn't recall half of the stuff that I drank. But
so you go from Ohio to a huge all-American list to, or mostly American list, I guess, to a much more Eurocentric list. How did you prepare for this job at what was then, I mean, the, you know, premier, other than maybe you had Veritas and maybe Crew, and those were the two best lists in the, you know, in the city at that point. How do you prepare for something like that? How do you get ready for that job?
Quickly. Because there wasn't much time in between. You had to, like, I mean, I had a copy of the wine list, like, literally with me the whole, it was only like a 2 week transition between Tribeca and Veritas. Yeah. And I was worried about that. I talked to Tim. I was like, listen, I don't know. Like, David Gordon is not a huge fan of Bordeaux, for example. And so there was like no Bordeaux on the wine list at Tribeca Grill, but Veritas had like an epic amount of Bordeaux. And I was like, what am I going to do?
And then you have these people who come in who, oh, wait a second, they've had that Bordeaux from that vintage like 20 times.
Yeah.
And they know it extremely well. Like, that's what I find intimidating sometimes. Like, when you have like collectors who are fanatics who really know those particular wines really well. And that's what I was afraid of going into Babbo. And I bet that you came across that a ton at, people just wanted to, you know, talk shop with Sam.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait a second, this is like, you guys really know what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, it's, it's like what I tell any sommelier, like confidence is 100% of it. You know what I mean? Like, you don't want to ever, like, and not being embarrassed to say you don't know. Like, I still say that. You know what I mean? There are wines that are on the wine list of Pearl and Ash that maybe I haven't checked in a while because, you know, I work with a collector of Pearl and Ash that has an amazing collection, and it's the same collection that I worked with at Gilt. You know, there are wines that I haven't checked in a couple of years, and people are like, so how is that drinking around? I'm like, you know what? It's been a while since I've been, but it's okay. You know what I mean? Like I feel really lucky to know a lot about a lot of these great wines that I've had a chance to taste, but wines change. Wines change significantly in a year's time. So I always tell like sommeliers who are, you know, kind of new in the industry, when they ask questions like that, I'm like, you know what? The number one, the best thing to do is be honest. Always. If you're not sure, don't lie, because you're going to open that bottle of wine and then everybody's going to find out if you're telling the truth. And that's dangerous. You know, you don't want to look like a poser, you know?
That's true. I mean, one of the things that I always say is that the most important thing is that you build trust of the guest.
For sure.
If you can build trust of the guest, by the end of the meal, you could say, I really think you should have that, like, $30 Calvados. And if they're like, this guy's been, like, taking care of me the whole time, they'd be like, fuck yeah, let's take the $30 Calvados. Yeah. But if they're like, oh, he's been selling me, and he looks like he's been fudging that, he doesn't really know, and he said something, but I don't know if he really meant it. Like,
right.
You know, if the glass was smudged and like the fork was off a little bit, and I guess like, what's going on here?
Right. No, and you're 100% right. Yeah. But you eventually do learn, by tasting. You know, that's the fun part about being a sommelier. So, you know, within a year of working at Veritas, I could tell you exactly how every first growth from the 96 vintage was drinking as opposed to the 95, like that specific, because we sold that much wine. I mean, I remember we used to have 96 Latour on the wine list for like $350. I mean, it's crazy.
That's like less than retail now.
Yeah, way less than retail. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I would drink that bottle if I came into a restaurant and they had it for that price. And it's epic wine. That 96 Latour is like, wow, it's money. I mean, I love Bordeaux. And now it's funny because now all of a sudden, like, Bordeaux is becoming fashionable again, or it's trying to. I mean, I think. And, you know, Richard Betts is doing a project there too, which is actually really cool. And but that's, you know, big concentration. I mean, the list at Pearl and Ash has a lot of Bordeaux on it, and I've kind of come under a little bit of fire for that, but it's all like amazingly well-priced vintage depth Bordeaux, and I think Bordeaux's really good.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, Bordeaux is part of, you know, of your history, stuff that you know you sold a lot of, you know, really well, that you're excited about. Downtown, you find, especially like in downtown restaurants, you didn't see Bordeaux at all. But I agree with you. I mean, even Daniel Janis, the great Daniel Janis, who you work with on the Paulet, you were one of our amazing leaders, and let's talk about that in a little bit about Paulet.
Yeah.
But even Daniel Janis is importing some Bordeaux now, he is like the most known just for Burgundy and nothing else, right?
For sure, he's a I mean, when he first told me that he was working with some Bordeaux producers, I was like, wow, really? Daniel is, I mean, he's a lover of all wines. You know what I mean? Like I remember, like, cruelly at some point early in my career, like, we do a lunch. We have done this holiday lunch, and it was a lunch that I never was involved with. I remember when I was a waiter at Tribeca Grill, I used to watch every Christmas time or whatever, David Gordon, Tim Kopeck, and Daniel Janis would do this lunch. And they would go to some restaurant and they would all bring a great bottle of wine, and David would come back and tell me all about the wines they drank, and it was like Cosh and Rayas and all this crazy shit. And I was like, wow, dude, that's amazing. I'm like, someday I'm going to break into that lunch. Someday I'm going to make it happen. And eventually, after a few years of begging them, I think they finally invited me and Yoshi along. And I brought a bottle of like a California Chardonnay and blind tasted them on, it might've been like Martinelli or Markson or something like that. And Daniel's like approach on it. He's such a gentleman. The way that he, like, you know, he didn't. I think he knew what the wine was, but did not want to hate on it at all. And you would expect, like, he would be like, oh, this is like some oaky swill. But he was very good about like pointing out all the things that were great about the wine. And, you know, he even took the point, he was like, you know, I think this is probably a New World wine, but I think it's right on par with like a Premier Cru White Burgundy. So like, I think he always is open. Like if you taste with him, you see, he always looks for the value. Most sommeliers, I think, look for the bad in a wine first, but Daniel always looks for the good in a wine, which I think is unique. No, most people don't do that, I think. So where were we going with this? Oh, talking about him buying Bordeaux. So yeah, so I mean, when he started working with
Bordeaux, and our mutual love, affection, admiration of Daniel Johns.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that guy. Without him, I wouldn't be where I am. I mean, the first trip I ever took to Burgundy was with Daniel, and this was 2003, 2004, and we went and visited Henri Jaillet, and it was just before he died. And I sat on Henri Jaillet's couch in his office, and Daniel stood between us and translated a conversation. And, you know, like we didn't even taste any wine at that point because he was done making wine. But like to have that opportunity and like just to get a glimpse into like arguably one of the best winemakers to have ever lived on this planet. And it was pretty special. So, I mean, that was for me, that sealed the deal. I would at that point would do anything for Daniel, but yeah. He's a great guy. And now we do the Palais, as you mentioned, you know, the Palais. This was my first year as chef sommelier. So it's a role that David Gordon always held. And he still is assisting me in the role because it's a big role. I mean, as you know, like controlling 50 sommeliers or at least trying to lead 50 sommeliers is like trying. I think David Lynch sent me an email about it. He's like, it's like herding cats. It's 100% true. I mean, you know, our there's a lot of most sommeliers tend to be very proud of who they are as people. And that's good. I mean, I'm proud of them. But when you get that many big personalities who are constantly being, you know, affirmed about who they are and how great they are, what they do, sometimes it's hard to get them all to do one thing. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? But the team is awesome. I mean, this was one of the best polys. So it was my first one as a chef sommelier. And I thought it went really well. Yeah. I mean, unless you thought differently.
No, I'm still in awe, and I still feel like someone's going to find out that I'm not good enough to be there. Like, that's my whole fear the whole time. I'm like,
you should worry
crap.
About that, actually. I have some notes that we'll talk about later.
No. Oh, my God. It's like, there's some of, like, the greatest sommeliers in the country who know these wines back and forth, and I just try to absorb as much as possible. Like, when you could be working on a team with you and Raj Parr and Aldo Sohm and Thomas and Bobby Stuckey and just like list goes on the best people in the industry. So it's like, I'm just going to shut up as much as possible and try to like listen and ask questions. And that's great. I mean, there are definitely people who've been there like since the beginning or multiple years or have more experience, and I'll ask them lots of questions. Like Drew Hendricks was super helpful.
Yeah.
Just ask everyone lots and lots of questions. And it's such a learning experience for me. I feel just lucky to be part of that awesome team.
Yeah, no, it's special. It's special. We need to drink some of the champagne, man.
Because, oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
This is what I normally have for breakfast.
All right.
Yeah. Sometimes I put a little orange juice in it just for fun.
No, come on now. So what are you opening up right now?
This is Ulysse Cullen, who is one of my all-time, well, not one of my, I mean, yeah, he's definitely one of my all-time favorite champagne producers. Sorry, I'm going to make some noise here.
All right.
So he's a guy who learned from Solos. So Anselm Solos, Domaine Jacques Solos.
Well, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have you open up that champagne.
Yes.
We're going to drink it during a little break and then come up with some witty things to say about it.
All right.
Back.
I look forward to that.
All right.
This song is called Bang Bang Sun by Iggy Dean on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thank you.
Bonnie knows when you plant something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie, gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
And we're back on In the Drink. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, here with Patrick Capiello, the beverage director and partner of Pearl and Ash. He's just popped open some killer bubbles for us, which is awesome. Also, we were talking about before the chef sommelier at La Pole, and Patrick's also just worked at kind of all many of the best, just the top wine places in the city, including Tribeca Grill, Veritas, Gilt, and now the recently New York Times just loved up on you, Pearl and Ash, which is quickly becoming the wine destination downtown, thanks to your hard work and good cheer.
Thanks. Yeah. It's been a pretty intense experience. You know, it's the first, as I mentioned, I've closed quite a few restaurants, including Gilt, which just closed in December, but it wasn't something I was happy to have being known for. I've literally never opened a restaurant before. This is the first time. At the ripe old age of 40, I finally opened a restaurant, and it was really kind of I'm gonna get some of that too.
Yeah,
so drink some champagne. It's good. But it's kind of been an amazing experience to go through not only like the ways of having to open a restaurant, like all the stuff that goes into it, and you think you know about how to run a restaurant, and like until you have to start from scratch, and you've done it so many times. I don't even know. I mean, like, after this one, I'm like, I'm never opening a restaurant again. Although I think we're already thinking about opening something else. But it was intense. And going through the critical part of it was probably the roughest, because I've never been, you know, we had highs and lows during our review process. And we very rapidly, like, I think from what I understand, quicker than most people have, like within a few short weeks, we already had people filing reviews on us. Because there was, you know, there was an immediate buzz, and from what I've gotten from other people who've gone through this experience, like their analysis, many people have said, you know, you started with so much internet buzz, you know, between Twitter and Instagram and everybody talking about what was going on there. And I think, you know, starting off by having a bunch of sommeliers come at friends and family, that was it. Like Robert Bohr came with Ned Benedict and Daniel Jonas and Richard Betts. They all came at a table, and they were like chomping at the bit to tweet about what was going on. They were like killing the wine list. We sold so much wine on Friends and Family. Like, that's supposed to be the free night for everybody to come, but they didn't want the free bottles, of course. They wanted to drink off the wine list. And like, it just, they wanted to tweet about it, but we weren't allowing them to tweet that weekend. But on Monday, when we opened for the first night, everybody just started going crazy tweeting about it. And this immediate buzz came on, and you know, I just assumed it was natural for all your friends to want to come and visit your restaurant. But it was like every day I would get email requests from sommeliers being like, "Can I come in? Can I come in? I heard the wine list is great." And then I found myself like thinking, we opened like a 200 bottle wine list. I'm like, you know what? I probably should keep this thing going. I rented a Zipcar at one point and drove out to New Jersey, where my collector who consigns with me lives, and like loaded it up. I'm like, I need more wine. I think I'm gonna be in trouble here. And you know, it became really quickly before we knew it, like, I don't remember who the first critic that came in was. It might have been Cuzo from the Post. He might have been the first. Or no, Ryan Sutton, I think, was probably the first guy that we noticed. Of course, we don't know what any of these guys look like, and we didn't notice they came in, you know, on the record. But, you know, I mean, you know, if I'm sure the critics know, but if you walk into the back of the house, any restaurant, there's like a picture of everything. It's like wanted posters, like everybody's pictures there. And
I was just down in Texas in Fort Worth, Texas, at Tim Love's place. Mm. Called the Woodshed, and even in the kitchen there, they had pictures of like barbecue reviewers.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's. I don't think it's cheating. I think it's. I mean, we try to treat every guest exactly the same, but when it's a critic, you know, like, you try to make sure that everything is even more like perfect than you have to make sure. I mean, you know, because you get one shot at it, or you know, whatever, a couple shots at it, but, and you know, I wouldn't acknowledge, you know, on the radio that I ever recognized when people else came in, but I think I had a feeling that it might have been him once or twice. And you know, I mean, but I treated him the same way I treat everybody else. Like at Pearl and Ash, it's a very laid back approach on wine. I think when you put a 500 bottle wine list in front of somebody on the Bowery, you got to be careful. It's like, it can be super intimidating. Mm-hmm. And it's like, not everybody's coming there. And our food costs like $11, you know what I mean, for a plate. So it's like, and it's Suwannee food. I mean, Richard Kuo, who's our chef, who was worked at WD50, at Cortone, at Show, he's got like, you know, serious chops. The guy knows how to cook really well, and it's beautiful food. But, you know, because of the pop-up he did over in Williamsburg called Frey, he learned how to turn simple and humble ingredients into really excellent food. And so the theme of the restaurant, and that's what Pearl and Ash means. It means it's like some Chinese parable that Richard heard as a child, where it's like you can have something as, you know, precious as a pearl, but you don't need to have it in like a fancy box. You can just have it in a, you know, a pile of ash. Like, that's the idea.
I love that. And I think that speaks to the sensibilities of how people like to eat now.
Yeah.
You know, definitely we all owe like Momofuku Sambar a big, you know, thank you for getting people comfortable with having kind of fine food in a casual downtown place.
Right.
But yeah, I think the food is just killer. I mean, I really think that Gabe Thompson, who's the chef at my business partner and the chef at our restaurants, makes like the most killer octopus, and I will like fight to the death to say that that is the best octopus. Until I tried your octopus, and it just blew my mind. Like, how could I like something as much as or more than Gabe's octopus? And so, yeah, the food is just absolutely killer. And it's just like, I also recently went through this like this whole review period time. I just think it's like the worst time in a restaurant's life.
Yeah,
it's you know, the conceptual phase, building it out, training people, getting excited about it, and then like actually serving people are all great. But then somewhere in the middle is this just horrible time of when you have to like be on edge. Like, I don't know about you, but I'd have these nightmares where I would like go over to a critic's table and like spill food on them while simultaneously sneezing all over their face. And, and then wake up, I'm like, oh my God, did that just happen?
It's nerve-wracking, man. Yeah. I think it's more scary than anything. But you know, if you've been to before Pearl and Ash, and like my move is, like I said, it's very like a casual approach. Like, mm-hmm. I sit down at the tables with people. If there's an empty seat at the table, I sit right down with them with the wine list. And it's only because I'm 6'2", and they're sitting on benches that are like a foot tall. You know what I mean? Like, there's no backs in the seats. It's all really awkward as far as like, you know, positioning yourself. It's not necessarily designed for somebody to have a huge wine list they have to go through. So, plus, I feel like coming down to people's level, like, or if I can't sit down, I'll like literally like squat down right next to them. But I think that, you know, having that type of service in that situation, it's the only way to go. But so, I mean, yeah, I mean, like when every critic came in, I mean, I sat down right with them. Like, I think at first, the first time I sat down next to Pete Wells, I think he looked a little shocked. He's like, what is wrong with this guy? Like, this isn't how it works. Like, you're not supposed to do this. But then I think he saw me sitting down with every other table in the restaurant. And, you know, in the review that he wrote really, I mean, I feel so like honored that he got it. Like, that was the way the review read to me.
I felt like that review was a good thing for not just the restaurant, but for the whole wine community, sommelier community in general. One of my big criticisms, if I can criticize the New York Times review.
You can, go
and
ahead.
I told Asimov when he was here as well. Like, I think that they don't spend enough time talking about the beverage program. It's become such an important part of what, you know, of how you plan out a restaurant, how you design it, how you train, everything from not just the wine, but cocktails and coffee and juices and all of this. And if there's a sentence about, you know, all that thought and time and effort that went into it in a review, then that's more than normal. So the fact that Pete Wells spent as much time talking about how great you are and how much I agree with him on that, I think that was just an awesome, awesome thing for everyone. So
yeah, it's been great for us. Although I mean, you know, it's my whole thought process with building the list there. And like, I came out as a consultant. Like, I was still the wine director of the New York Palace Hotel. Like, they had retained my services. And my thought was, I was just trying to make a wine list that I wanted to drink from. I live in that neighborhood. So I was like, there's nothing down there. It's like, but you look at, there was epic lists at time, like Little Frankie's and Frank had big wine lists. So they took a chance, and they're not far from there. Granted, it was all Italian, but it wasn't that far out of the box for somebody to want to put together a large wine list, I think. And then I would go to Ten Bells, like, which is like one of my favorite places. In fact, Fifi was in last night, which was such an honor to have him in. And their wine list doesn't extend for miles. I mean, it's written on a mirror, you know, if you've ever gone there, or a chalkboard or whatever. So it can only be as long as that. But they have a lot of cool natural wines. And, I was in Paris this past August, and I made it a point to really I wanted to experience what was going on new and fun in the Paris wine and food scene. And I went to, like, Vervolet, I went to Chateaubriand, I went to Frenchy. And the one thing I kept noticing at all these places, even though they were super casual bistro-style places with really innovative cuisine, they had awesome wine lists. Mm-hmm. And they were really well-priced. And I was like, why the hell doesn't this exist in New York? Like, and especially why not in Manhattan? Like, it makes sense. Like wine destination restaurants are like a dying breed. Like, Crew, Close, Veritas changed concept. You know, Gilt, when I was trying to make that the wine destination restaurant, but I think being that it was in a hotel made it a little difficult. But there wasn't, you know, 3,000 bottle selection there that nobody paid any attention to. I'm like, there's got to be a reason why. And I think the reason why is because people who drink wine don't necessarily want to drink DRC. I mean, they want to, yeah. but I don't think they can afford to. So the list was structured based on that kind of an attitude. I wanted to create something. So for me, I wanted to create something I could drink from. I was like doing this as a friend for my chef friend. And I was like, I'll just do F&B credit. Don't worry. I'm just going to come in and drink all this wine and put it on the wine list. And then it became this huge, you know, as we spoke about, this huge big thing. And before you know it, they were like, hey, how about you don't go back to the Palace Hotel? I'm like, how can we do that? And they're like, I don't know. You want to be a partner? And I was like, yeah, that sounds good. I've always wanted to own a restaurant. So yeah, it was a win-win, I think. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you definitely earned it. Like, and one of the things, I mean, you said a few times that you're casual, but when you go to the restaurant, you know, I'm used to seeing you in a suit. I'm used to seeing you in a well-tailored, 6'2", good-looking guy, well-tailored suit. You wear it really well. And then I come to the restaurant, I'm like, you working? And you're like, oh, yeah, this is what I wear at work now. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And you just see, like, your enthusiasm for what you're doing down there. And it just feels like at Pearl and Ash, you're, like, actually in, like, it's like observe Patrick in his native environment wearing a t-shirt and an open, you know, short sleeve button down. Look at the smile on his face as he sells some sick wine way underpriced.
Yeah.
It feels like you're definitely just grooving it there.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I collect more than wine is rock t-shirts. I have I have a dresser that's dedicated just to my t-shirts. So, and I've never, and the only time I ever wore them when I was doing cellar work at Guild, like, I never had the opportunity to wear any of these t-shirts. It was the one day off that I had, like, I would wear them out maybe, but it's so great to be able to, like, and now I'm like buying more t-shirts again. Like, I kind of stopped at some point because I was like, I have no more room. Literally, I bought a new dresser. One day I went to IKEA and just like bought a new dresser just to put my t-shirts in. And I was like, man, I really would love to wear these more. So, and it's been funny that, like, you know, like, even like Time Out New York mentioned it, and Village Voice, and then Pete Wells all mentioned like different rock t-shirts I was wearing. It was funny. Anytime a critic came in, I would retire that t-shirt so I wouldn't wear it again because I didn't want to duplicate any of the t-shirts. So I had like this whole pile of, you know, t-shirts that I couldn't wear until after the reviews were over. I was so happy because one of them was my Joy Division t-shirt, which is like my all-time favorite t-shirt. Yeah.
So just going back to this idea of the reviews just quickly.
Yeah.
Because when they started coming in, like within, you know, we opened up a week before Hurricane Sandy, and then we were closed for a week. And then the following week after that, the reviewers started coming in. Like,
amazing, right?
And, you know, that was something where it's like, oh, my God, like, this is just so ridiculous. We're just, like, getting back, and we're just opening. And, like, how could these guys be coming in right now? But at the same time, I felt, well, to a certain extent, this is, like, I hate this time of, like, I hate the whole the reviewing thing. The reason we get into the restaurants is not to, like, make critics happy, but to make people happy.
Right.
So it's kind of nice to get that all out of the way. Yeah. How do you feel? Like, what are your thoughts on it? Would you rather get out of the way? Or do you think it's better to have, like, a more accurate picture of a more fully mature restaurant?
I think for us, it's good to get it out of the way. I think because I think we really want to just have a lot of fun there. And not that it's not, you can't have fun with a critic's in the room, but it's a little more stuffy. And I think that it was starting to wear on the staff after a while. It was like, my God, like, well, who else is coming in again? Like, every day a new critic would be in there. And it was like, you know, the management gets nervous. I get nervous. The chef gets nervous. And the atmosphere gets less comfortable. And now we're having so much fun. Like, you know, the playlist is changing a little bit, you know, where I think we're really finding our groove now. And and also the food consistently gets better. I mean, I eat that menu every night. Like, every night that Brandon McCrill, our general manager, and Richard Kaur, chef, and myself sit down and eat the whole menu. every night just to make sure that the cooks are on it and killing it. And we have even seen everybody, like people that came for friends and family, like Mike Madrigal came for friends and family, and then he was there again like last night, and he was like, dude, the food, I mean, it was great already, but it's so much better now. Because, well, you get your groove on it, and I think once you're less focused on worried about who's going to come in and sit down, you can actually be like, okay, this we got into this because it's fun, right? We like to do this. So now we're actually able to just kind of take a deep breath and just really, you know, enjoy it for what it is. Yeah. It's great, and it's been like so busy, which is another great thing. You know what I mean? Like, to, you know,
what's the best time to go if you're at a...
Well, we're looking at
integrating... I went on a Friday night at 8 o'clock, which that's not going to happen again.
for you, we can work it out. We're trying to implement Open Table into it and have it make sense. The idea was we wanted to make it a walk-in place, and you know, the best thing about that neighborhood is that there's a million places to get a drink around, like Pegu Club's around the corner, Experimental Cocktail Club just opened up. I mean, there's so many great cocktail bars and fun bars that go to. And, you know, we have a system where when you come in, we'll take your phone number, go grab a drink, and when you're ready, we'll text you, and then you come back. So I think, you know, if you come, the earlier you come, obviously, the better chance you have of getting a table. But if you don't want to eat at 5:30, which I understand, I mean, I eat at 5:30, but it's called lunch, you know? Like, I think if you just plan your night so that you're not starving when you arrive, and if you have to wait a little bit, you know, it moves quick. So I don't want to commit to anybody what time the best time to come in is on the radio. Anytime is a good time to come in. Yeah, come in. That's all we want. That's all the
and drink the wine.
Yeah.
Speaking of the wine, I've been just loving this Ulis Cologne. It's the Blanc de Blanc.
Yeah, Blanc de Blanc. This is makes two different vineyards. This is from Le Perrier, which is I think it's the first vineyard he took back. His story is like so many stories in Champagne. Young guys whose families have owned vineyards for generations and have always sold them off to one of the big houses. You know who those guys are. You know, the guys that you see at every liquor store, and, you know, come in bottles that have like yellow labels or whatnot. So they would sell it off to one of the big houses to juice the grapes. And, you know, there's been a movement for Anselm Sloss, who's kind of started this idea of it's okay to make 20,000 cases of champagne. You can do it, and you can sell it, and you can sell it in the United States. He proved that it's possible. So these young guys who kind of watched that movement happening in Champagne have grabbed onto it, and now it's, as these land leases are taking up, they're taking the vineyards back, and they're getting an opportunity to make wines on their own. So Ulis did some training with Sloss a few years, and as his family's leases went up, he took back the property and then started making the wine. So they're really, for me, great. I mean, they're wines that have tension, but richness and power. Like, they're wines that are so aromatically expressive. I mean, for me, it's like just jumps from the glass. It's these guys are all about making single varietals from single vintages. And even like a guy like this, who's, you know, he doesn't have the ability to, by law, you have to have like, what is it, like 3 years or 5 years. This is where I need an MS in the room, but I think it's 3 years of lease time in order to, so the wine sitting on its lease in order to declare the vintage. So even though this wine is made entirely from one 36. Vintage, it's 2008, they can't put a vintage date on it because it doesn't spend enough time in the cellar. But this guy doesn't have like an epic cellar to age all his champagne in. He's just a farmer. So it's kind of another way that the laws have screwed over guys like this, but he does, you know, he rises above it, and you know, so it's more Burgundian in style, was my point, because it's one varietal from one place, from one vintage, very similar to the Burgundy theory.
Yeah, and, you know, we're drinking it in white wine glasses, and it's really, I mean, I'm thinking, wow, this is a great, like, Chablis, really good Burgundy, and I forget that it has bubbles until you actually taste it.
It's true. Yeah, it drinks like a white Burgundy. You're 100% right. It's so good.
It's killer. So it's a grower champagne, single vintage, single grape, single vineyard.
Yep. 100% Chardonnay from 2008, this one. A lot of them put the vintage dates encoded on there, like for him.
Lot 2008.
Yeah, exactly. See how it says L08 on the back there? And they even put disgorgement dates on too, which is another thing, you know, even with non-vintage champagnes, or people like Solos does like this crazy Solera that's aged, he adds equal parts that he takes out back to the, I think 84 was when he started the substance. But he puts disgorgement dates on everything. And that's important to know, because if you walk into a liquor store and it's a wine that doesn't have a vintage date on it, you don't know how long that thing's been sitting there. And a disgorgement date gives you the opportunity to see it. So more and more you're seeing disgorgement dates on the back, so... It's good information to have for champagne.
I think it's interesting, geeky information to have. But personally, I feel like a wine like this, if it was cellared properly, disgorged in 2012, it's good 5, 10, 15 years.
At least.
But if it's something that's like your average, you know, non-vintage champagne,
right.
then you want the fresher disgorging
date. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Like, I'd be worried if you could tell on some of those bigger houses, like, you know, who knows how long that thing's been sitting in the case stack at the liquor store, you know?
And it just becomes a commodity, and it's just like... Yeah, is this something that's on the list?
Oh yeah. This is on the, we have every one of his vineyards. He makes three different vineyards. He makes a Blanc de Noir, which is 100% Pinot Noir, and then he makes two different Blanc de Blancs. Yeah, I've always been a big fan. I buy as much of it as I can. Actually, right now we're pouring the Blanc de Noir by the glass, Mayon, which is awesome, so delicious. I got like, you know, two cases of it, but I was like, you know, I want to share this wine, so I put it on for, I think, really affordably by the glass, so you can come in and have an opportunity to taste cool stuff like this. So I
remember when we were first talking about Pearl and Ash, and you're like, yeah, these guys asked me to do it, and I was like, all right, I'll do it, but you know, I have two conditions. You said to me, you're like, I get to put on Bordeaux downtown, and number two, everything has to be like just so affordably priced, has to be marked down like way lower. Yeah. And like, you see, like, I'm going to kill these guys on their cogs.
Beverage cost is not good. And you know, but you know what? They get it. Like, the guy who is our fourth partner, who, you know, prefers to just not be mentioned, like, which I think is so cool. He owns the building and he gets it. You know what I mean? Like, there was a restaurant there before us that didn't do too well. And I think, for him to see what's going on right now, he's like, head is spinning. He can't believe it. And, you know, we have our monthly meeting, our monthly P&L meeting, and I'm like, yeah, so that's the beverage cost that I was warning you about. And it's high, but it's we're busy, and they see many of my sommelier friends are like, yeah, man, you can't take beverage cost to the bank. And they're right. I mean, and not only that, the value. Like, I want people to be like, oh, wow, like, I'm totally taking one over. These guys have no idea how much this wine is worth, man. This is way too cheap. Like, I want people to feel that way. I never want anyone to feel like, oh, man, I want to drink that bottle of wine, but they're totally trying to screw me over on this. Like, that's, who wants to feel that way? Yeah. You know what I mean? I think if you can convince, for anyone listening to this, if you can convince your restaurant owner that a higher beverage cost is a better move, I think you'll be rewarded. I mean, I've seen it, and it's going to stay that way. We're not, you know what I mean? Like, people are like, oh, yeah, once a review comes out, you're going to raise prices. We're not raising prices. Prices are staying the same, or else I won't be there anymore. I won't put my name on it anymore. Well, unless it's
how deep is the cellar of the guy who's helping you out? Are you gonna at some point? Are you gonna have to start looking elsewhere?
No, I mean, I've always had other collectors. I mean, when I was at Guild, I had two collectors, and that other collector is still available. And now I have two more guys that are clients that love the restaurant so much and have always wanted to consign with me. But I was waiting, kind of, to make sure that this was all real. Like, I was pinching myself a lot of the times, and now I'm ready. So we're gonna see. We're building a new wine cellar starting next week. And we're going to have a capacity of 4,000 bottles, and the wine list is probably going to jump over 1,000 in the next month or two. So be ready for that.
What?
Yeah. And this one guy's collection is really amazing. Like, I mean, I thought that the one guy I have now is great. This next guy, like, it's going to be next level.
All right. So by the end of the summer.
Yeah.
It'll be 1,000.
Yeah.
Yes. Label.
I will commit to that.
On the freaking Bowery. Oh my God. The place where when I started at NYU, I would walk more quickly across it because I was afraid of all of the bad stories of the Bowery. And now we have 1,000 bottle, you know, list curated by freaking Patrick Caffiello, Chef Smollier, La Palais, and like Smollier, like all these like grand award winning restaurants on the Bowery, freaking with incredible food. That is so cool. I'm just ecstatic. Just the thought of that.
I'm pretty excited about it too.
Cool, man. Well, I mean, I'm going to encourage everyone. I've been there myself multiple times recently to check out Pearl and Ash. Say hi to Patrick. He's been there every time I've been there. So, and drink some great wine off that list. It's one of those lists where it encourages you to spend a little more than you normally would because you know that it's half the price of anywhere else you'd see it in the city.
It's true.
And eat some delicious food there. So thanks so much for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.